Mueller says Manafort breached his plea deal by repeatedly lying. Trump calls Mueller a conflicted prosecutor gone rogue. This hour, numerous developments in the Russia probe. It's a Politics Wednesday edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. On board this hour, political scientists Jim McCormick of Iowa State University and Tim Hagel of the University of Iowa. Also today, Senator Grassley says the president should move quickly to nominate a new attorney general. Congress is back in a lame duck session. Tear gas used on migrants on our southern border and the Ukraine-Russia sea clash. What's behind the escalation? Politics at home and abroad follows this news.
Coming out, you know, and expressing themselves about what happened to them.
I really hope the Me Too movement is propelling us in that direction where assaulting people has consequences.
I think it's important that we listen to all of the women that are coming out and telling their stories and work on how we can engage them in a healing process.
The Me Too movement has led many people to share their experiences with sexual harassment and sexual assault. It has sparked conversations and controversy and maybe even change. I'm Charity Nebbe. Look for Unsettled, Mapping Me Too, a new podcast from Iowa Public Radio in the iTunes Store and on Google Play, or find it at iowapublicradio.org.
It's a Politics Wednesday edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Today, we have the expertise of Tim Hagel, Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Iowa, in our Iowa City studio. Hi, Tim.
Hey there.
And Jim McCormick, Professor of Political Science at Iowa State University, in our Ames studio. Hi, Jim.
Hi, Ben.
And we want to mention, congratulations in order, I think. You are this year's holder of the Whitaker Lindgren Faculty Fellowship in Political Science.
Thank you.
Whitaker Lindgren. I take it not the Whitaker in our news.
No, not at all.
She's
an alum of Iowa State and a generous donor, actually, to our department.
Well, congratulations, Jim McCormick, on that fellowship for this year. Well, picking apart politics as usual from the last few days, and there's plenty to pick apart. Senator Grassley saying that the president should move quickly to nominate a new attorney general. Congress back in session, a lame duck session. I'd like to have your thoughts on that agenda. Tear gas in the news on immigrants, migrants, and our southern border. Also, the Ukraine-Russia sea clash. What's behind that escalation? We'll get to that a little bit later in the program. But as I count up almost maybe a half dozen developments in the Russia probe, let's talk about that and invite our listeners to join our conversation at 1-866-780-9100, 1-866-780-9100, or email us river2river@iowapublicradio.org. Let's see. To survey quickly what we've been hearing the last few days, we found out that this week Paul Manafort's lawyer briefed the president's team. A lawyer repeatedly talked to President Trump's legal team about his client's discussions with federal investigators. This came even after the plea agreement with the special counselor, Bob Mueller. Yesterday, Donald Trump again criticizing Mueller's investigation of Russian election interference. I guess no news there. That comes on a weekly basis. An associate, though, for the former Trump advisor, Roger Stone, released documents yesterday showing that Stone tried in 2016 to find out what information WikiLeaks had that could hurt Hillary Clinton's campaign. And finally, also on the WikiLeaks note, this is according to The Guardian of Britain's newspaper, former Trump campaign chairman Paul Manafort is alleged to have met with WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange at the Ecuadorian embassy in London several times between 2013 and 2016, including a meeting in March of 2016. This would have been just months before the first WikiLeaks publication of the Democratic National Convention documents. Wow, that's a lot to happen in a few days. Tim Hagel, what do you put at the top of the heap here, and what do you draw out of it?
Well, one of the things is, let's start with the Guardian story, is apparently I saw something earlier today suggesting that The Guardian had stealth edited that article, and perhaps those claims, initial claims about this alleged meeting between Manafort and Assange had not taken place. Mm-hmm. I didn't read the entire article. I just sort of skimmed the aspects of it, and so I'm not really sure what's going on there. And that's kind of what the problem with a lot of this is we get all this information, and it's really hard to tell how much of it's legitimate, how much of it is actually based on something solid as opposed to these sort of rumors that are going around one way or another. And I still am, you know, sometimes it's difficult to take this position, but it's still kind of that, well, just wait until Mueller issues his report. Okay, that's the substance of what we're looking for rather than these tangential sorts of things.
Okay, granted, I haven't seen the confirmation for the Guardian story either, but we did find out, and this is confirmed, that Paul Manafort's lawyer confirmed by all involved that he's been repeatedly talking to the president's legal team.
And apparently there was nothing improper about doing that, though it sounds a little odd. But
highly unusual was the characterization I heard. What does that tell you, Tim Hagel, with your legal background?
Well, I guess at one level it tells folks that you want to get your story straight and find out what one person is telling another person. One of the concerns that a number of people have had, and legitimately so, is the concern that I don't know if I want to say exactly a perjury trap, but you want to make sure that you're telling Mueller's investigators the truth or something that can be factually backed up, even if it's somewhat vague in terms of what's going on, because a number of people have gotten in trouble for lying to the FBI, lying to the investigators or whoever it happens to be, or not telling the truth. And of course, Manafort's got a problem in that he's got the plea agreement in place, and so he has to be truthful or else they'll come after him again or change his sentence or something along those lines. And so those attorneys to be talking to Trump's attorneys, well, it's a matter of making sure that, okay, this is what we told them or this is what the approach was, something along those lines before Trump either agrees to have a meeting, or I don't know if he's actually submitted his written responses to mm-hmm. those questions. There was some hint that he had already done so and then maybe not. But in any case, you want to make sure that you're on the same page to a certain extent, or at least to the extent that's legally permissible.
Mm-hmm. Jim McCormick, weigh in on these developments. What's top of the heap
for
you?
I think what is really at the top for me is that, in fact, Mueller has people have said that Manafort did not live up to his plea agreement here, that he lied subsequently. I'd be very interested in seeing exactly what the dimensions of that lying was or mm-hmm. misleading. I think that may be more the story than because the Mueller office has not come out with any kind of confirmation of the Guardian story about the Ecuadorian embassy meetings, which I think would be quite a bombshell if they
yes, it would, wouldn't it?
Would really were true, because that would really show a much more of a direct link here. So I think the accusation of misleading the Mueller team after they had made the plea agreement, but I haven't been able to discern exactly what area he has that Manafort had misled the Mueller team.
Right, and I think that's yet to come from what I've seen in the uh-huh. reporting, the specifics of that. And a lot of speculation on to why Manafort, who we can't get into Manafort's head, but some legal experts speculating that the former campaign manager of Trump, Manafort, agreed to this unusual arrangement of sharing information in a bid for a pardon. That's out there, too. I mean, would that be an explanation for you, Tim Hagel?
Well, it certainly sounds like it. And certainly one of the speculation has been for a long time is that not just Manafort, but others as well would want a pardon from Trump. And certainly they would like to. Politically, it would be problematic for Trump to do so. Of course, he's, you know, bucked politics in the past. But I think this is something that really would get people upset. Now, of course, Trump's still saying, look, there was no collusion. So if there's no collusion, then he really doesn't have a reason at this point to pardon them. And we'll have to wait and see. If Mueller's report comes out and Trump is clean in that regard, then maybe those folks could get a pardon at that point and have it be politically sustainable for Trump. But again, we have to wait and see to what that report says. I also would like to see what the allegations are in terms of misleading from how Manafort may have misled. It could have been you know, something where he left out some information as opposed to an outright lie? And, depending on what the circumstances were, did it have something to do with his Ukraine connection, which is what got him in trouble in the first place, or something directly related to the campaign? We just don't know at this point. And, of course, not surprisingly, Manafort's lawyers say, no, we were being truthful.
To add to that, Jim, on the pardon speculation?
Yeah, I think that that's really very likely that this kind of sharing of information, this kind of coordination of positions certainly would enhance the probability that the president would look favorably on that. But I think that that's probably down the road. That's going to be after sentencing, if there's really any kind of consideration of that. And I think there'll be a little bit of distance between the sort of the Mueller report, the sentencing, and even if the president would contemplate that. I can't imagine him dropping that rather quickly, you know, into the political arena. I just think it would be so harmful to him. I'm a little bit, you know, I don't know. You mentioned this Corsi and Stone kind of accusations. It's very curious of how all of this, you know, fits in, except that you know, that they were passing on information. If in fact the accusations with regard to Corsi having this email and so on, that he had information that the WikiLeaks were going to occur, and sort of the timing of them, if that actually went on to the Trump campaign, that's pretty troublesome and problematic as well for the Trump administration.
During our conversation, Jim McCormick with us of Iowa State University, Tim Hagel of the University of Iowa. Your thoughts on political developments? We're focused on the several developments in the Russia probe investigation. 1-866-780-9100. River to river at iowapublicradio.org. Well, the Senate Judiciary Chairman, now for a little while, he'll be changing in the new year. Our U.S. Senator Chuck Grassley said Donald Trump should move quickly to nominate a new attorney general to end demands for hearings on his appointment of Matthew Whitaker as the acting head of the Justice Department. Senator Grassley says that Whitaker's controversial history is attracting scrutiny.
We got an acting attorney general, appoint somebody, and all these questions about Whitaker would go away unless Whitaker was his nominee. Then, of course, they'd be enhanced a great deal.
All right. Grassley says he's aware of a slate of potential nominees, but isn't committed to any of them. Jim, you first on this. This is tied to the Russia probe here.
Right.
Whitaker overseeing, now that Jeff Sessions gone, overseeing Bob Mueller directly, right?
Yeah, I think it's very significant that Senator Grassley, you know, given that Whitaker is from Iowa and so on, that he came out with this rather strong statement that the president should act very quickly. I did note in the interview that was published today in the Washington Post with between some reporters and the president that the president did say that he had some names under consideration. I don't know how quickly he will act. I think he probably feels a little bit more secure given that the Senate, you know, gained some additional Republican senators in getting somebody confirmed here. Would he do it before the end of the year? I kind of doubt it because of the legislative agenda is so crowded here. I think, you know, the nomination will have to really go into the new year, where it will probably get more attention than if he could crowd it in among all these other activities. So I think probably he would take some of the sort of the lightning out of these criticisms if he at least announced who he's going to nominate, and that nominee, you know, had if this possible in this political environment, had an impeccable political and legal record here.
And it's not Whitaker.
And it's not Whitaker. That's right.
Tim Hagel.
Yeah, one of the things that surprised me about this was how quickly the knives came out for Whitaker. On the other hand, maybe it's, if I thought this through a little bit more, given that Whitaker's name had come up as a potential replacement for Sessions before Sessions resigned, was forced to resign, that I suppose it gave people lead time to sort of dig up information on Whitaker and, of course, his past in terms of criticizing the investigation, which was something that endeared him and that, no doubt, to Trump, was also something that was going to make him unpalatable to Democrats in particular. And so when he did get that sort of move into that position, that they were ready for that sort of thing and kind of came at him hard.
It wasn't hard to dig up the information. We had a lot of questionable business practices.
Well, that's the thing. Is that somebody's got that sort of background where you can question these sorts of things, and maybe they hadn't vetted him sufficiently. On the other hand, they figure, well, maybe from being in that position of the chief of staff for Sessions, it was an easy move. And certainly in that position, you're well aware with the sort of the day-to-day operations. And so in that sense, there isn't that sort of tumult in terms of that changeover. But of course, when you've got this political thing going on the outside, then that can make the day-to-day operations a little bit more difficult than what you were anticipating, which is unfortunate. So yeah, I would agree with Jim in the sense that it's probably not going to be wise to appoint Matt Whitaker, because that's just going to make the problems linger for people. Of course, if Matt doesn't fire Sessions and doesn't really interfere with the Mueller investigation, then perhaps a lot of this is just talk at this point.
Doesn't fire Mueller. Sessions is already gone, right?
Sessions is already gone. Doesn't fire Mueller.
Right. Okay.
I think the other complication of this, of course, was the way that Whitaker was appointed. I mean, the usual step would be to do the deputy attorney general here, and using this Successions Act here also, just gave another sort of card, if you will, to those that wanted to criticize Whitaker.
Mm-hmm. Also attached to this, the Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell weighing in yesterday, saying he would probably block future attempts to vote on legislation to prevent President Trump from firing Special Counsel Mueller. Here's a bit of audio from McConnell gathered by The Washington Post.
Well, I think you know my view. This is a solution in search of a problem. The president's not going to fire Robert Mueller, nor do I think he should, nor do I think he should not be allowed to finish. We have a lot of things to do to try to finish up this year without taking votes on things that are completely irrelevant to outcomes.
All right. And Jim, so this is really tied up again. We're talking about the lame duck session here. I want to throw in here, too, that I understand that Jeff Flake of Arizona, now he's outgoing. He's giving up his seat. He will be replaced. He said he will oppose all judicial nominees until he gets a vote on a bill that would somehow codify protections for the special counsel investigations.
Yeah, I think they were also talking about attaching it maybe to one of these appropriations bill that are required in terms of the government shutdown, and that would all sort of force a vote. But I did notice over the weekend that several other senators, sort of endorsed Flake's view that there ought to be a view, there ought to be a vote, excuse me, there ought to be a vote on this kind of legislation. I think Senator Grassley actually endorse this, that they ought to come up for a vote on this.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just wondering, if McConnell, obviously he controls the legislative agenda within the Senate, but, how long will he hold out if it's tied up with one of these appropriations bill and a government shutdown, and if there's kind of a trade-off with regard to some border security funding? I mean, there's a considerable disparity between the amount that the House has approved here and what the Senate is talking about in terms of border security. So, I mean, there may be, as we often see, some kind of a compromise at the 11th hour here, and maybe they'll put all of this, as they do sometimes with the appropriations bill, in a continuing resolution and, lop it over into January or beyond.
An observation from one of our listeners, Tom in Des Moines, emailing us: Trump will wait until the new year to nominate a new attorney general, not only because he has more Republicans in the new Congress, as in the Senate, I think Tom there in Des Moines means, but because he wants Whitaker to stand in as long as possible in case he wants to act against Mueller. There's a thought, Tim Hagel. Keep that option there as long as he can.
I don't think that that – I mean, that's a possible way of thinking about it, but I don't know that it would make that much difference. As I think Jim had mentioned earlier, if you basically make the announcement now, it tends to tamp down the fury that's being shown over Whitaker right now, knowing that there's this potential. Because certainly if a nominee is announced now, nothing's going to happen until the new Congress anyway. So that may be to Trump's advantage. Going back to the Flake situation and the protection of Mueller bill, just before I came in, apparently there was something introduced in the Senate, and it was Flake and I think Booker and a third Democratic senator or another Democratic senator that was part of it, and that required unanimous consent. And it was actually Senator Mike Lee, a Republican from Utah, that objected to it. And so at least the latest attempt to get something through had failed. And so we sort of have to wait and see what's going to happen. And as far as other Republican senators maybe wanting to have a vote, I did hear Senator Cornyn, Republican from Texas, indicate, well, if we have to have a vote, we have to have a vote. So it's not like he was really enthused about it, but realized the practical nature is that if Flake was going to hold up the judicial nominees, that they may have to have this vote just to continue to get them through.
Mm-hmm. It's kind of puzzling because McConnell has said that he doesn't think that Mueller's going to get fired and so on, and I'm not sure why. I guess it's only as in terms of his relationship with Trump that he wants to hold up a vote. It seems a bit curious here. I mean, he talks about the legislative calendar being crowded. Well, that's a very weak explanation.
It's always crowded.
With one word from Mitch McConnell, this could be done in an afternoon or a half an hour, couldn't
Absolutely.
It?
Absolutely. Yeah.
I mean, it's a half an hour, and you're done, and you're saying, okay, we don't think it's going to happen. The president.
It depends on what the protections are that are in such a bill.
Mm-hmm.
Well, okay. That's fair enough. Yeah. I mean, how far it will go? I mean,
Right. It's not a light switch, on or off. Protection, no protection, is it?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Good point, Tim Hagel. Let's talk about this in the remaining minutes before we go up to the break. The lame duck session, this was one of the things in there, but we've got a lot of other things hanging in the balance for the lame duck session. Among them, the reauthorization of the farm bill, criminal justice rewrite there. The border wall, I don't know. Is the president willing to shut down the government this time to get his border wall money? Tim Hagel, start us off before we go to break here and tell us what your thoughts are on this lame duck session.
Well, of course, as we're well aware at this point, President Trump tends to have a different approach to these sorts of things. And my guess is that he, unlike some prior presidents, both Republicans and Democrats, might be more willing to just go ahead, all right, let's shut it down and see what happens, basically to call the bluff. Or if it's not a bluff, to basically try to brazen yourself through on it. And, he may be right that sometimes Republicans are a little too scared because they usually get the blame for this kind of a shutdown. But on the other hand, you still have the dynamics of what's going on in the Senate and actually the House as well, given that they're going to be losing power, that they have concerns and things. And, of course, they're already looking forward to the next election. That's basically a constant election cycle at this point. So I don't think that they would want to shut down. So we'll probably see, as was indicated, maybe this some kind of continuing resolution or something to get us through at least the appropriation bills. What happens with the farm bill or the criminal justice reform, that remains to be seen.
Mm-hmm. What will you be watching, Jim, in this lame duck session?
I really will be watching, not only the farm bill, but the appropriations bill here, because that really is the thing that makes the government run. And we're not just talking about one appropriations bill. We're talking about seven different areas of activity for the government. So I think that's the, sort of the critical thing to watch. I very much agree with Tim. I think that the idea that the public at large would stand for a government shutdown and, that members of Congress, they know who will get blamed. They will get blamed back home. And given the 2016 election, even though the Republicans did well in the Senate, the House, I think is up to about 40 seats that they lost. So they're so those members are going to be looking over their shoulder, it seems to me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yesterday in the Senate, Cindy Hyde-Smith of Mississippi winning a special runoff election, defeating Mike Espy, the Democrat. The Republicans increasing their majority in the Senate and down by 39, maybe 40 seats.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I think one seat perhaps still officially undecided, if my tally's right there, Jim?
Yes, that's what I understand, yes.
Okay, we'll be back in just a moment to talk more. Let's talk about what happened on the border, tear gas and migrants. Depending on which newscast you watched or listened to, you got a much different view. We'll talk about that when we come back. I'm Ben Kiefer with Jim McCormick and Tim Hagel, our political scientist, on this edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. And we're back with more of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Politics Wednesday with Tim Hagel of the University of Iowa, Jim McCormick of Iowa State University, our political scientist. If you'd like to join our discussion on surveying the politics of the last few days, please join us. 1-866-780-9100. River to River at iowapublicradio.org. Let's address this quickly. The advisor to the president and first daughter Ivanka Trump defending her use of a private email account in an ABC News interview yesterday. She insisted there is no connection between her situation and Hillary Clinton's email scandal.
Well, there really is no equivalency. All of my emails that relate to any form of government work, which was mainly scheduling and logistics and managing the fact that I have a home life and a work life, are all part of the public record. They're all stored on the White House system. So everything has been preserved, everything's been archived. There just is no equivalency between the two things.
But people see it as the same.
People who want to see it as the same see it as the same.
Okay, so Jim McCormick, what do you think about that? Does she have a point? Is there an equivalency? Any degree of equivalency?
Pretty minor equivalency, it seems to me. I mean, because the issue with Secretary Clinton, of course, was classified emails, and certainly it was a considerable longevity. The other thing with the Clinton case was that not all of them were stored. Well, many of them were not stored, and some of them have, you know, been apparently, you know, destroyed and so on. So
We had the Clinton server in her house.
And the server in her house as well. Yeah. So, yeah, it's a pretty much of a stretch. It's maybe a one day story from the news business.
Do you see it that way, Tim?
Yeah, pretty much. I think that the way Ivanka Trump said that if people want to see that it's the same, they're going to. And basically it provides folks an argument saying, oh, well, you complained about this. Why aren't you complaining about that? But, yeah, the differences are pretty stark.
Okay. But to push back a little bit against both of you, how, after the campaign we had in 2016, seared into our memory about emails, how can Ivanka Trump make a straight-faced argument that she didn't know the rules that we're governing the use of personal email when conducting government business?
No, that's a good question. It's one that people have been asking about in the days that this has been a one-day story.
Jim, really, come on.
Well, I mean, it's a very fair question. I agree. I mean, we have politicians are, I guess, human beings is the only explanation here.
All right.
And they don't always absorb kind of the lessons that they should absorb. I mean, it's beyond me why they would do that. I guess they would think, well, I'm not going to, you know, this is just fairly minor, and I'm not going to revealed on this in any event. But that clearly is not the case. So that's a fair point, Ben, that you make.
Okay, we'll move on from there. I guess I'm surprised a little bit by both of your reaction there, but this hour is full of surprises, and that's the way we like it. Let's talk about the border situation. NPR reporting on this in an interesting way. The situation at the land port of entry, San Ysidro, chaotic and confusing in the last few days. Reactions from the American public suggest that photos and footage from the scene serve as a sort of Rorschach test, according to NPR. I thought this was an interesting article. For instance, on Sunday, U.S. agents closing a major border crossing, firing tear gas at migrants attempting to cross into the U.S. from Tijuana. The immigrants, many of whom had been part of that caravan of Central American asylum seekers, were protesting the slow pace at which they were being processed as asylum claims. Now, for Donald Trump supporters who advocate a crackdown on immigration, the events on Sunday, you could tune in, see television showing immigrants storming a protected barrier confirming the fears of an invasion of immigrants, defying the U.S. laws. Now, for critics, though, of the president's actions, you saw American Patrol agents firing tear gas at unarmed people, children, mothers, reinforcing the thing. So Jim, you first of all, give us your thoughts on this. What happened at the border, and where it puts us?
Well, it's sort of hard to unravel all of it, but one of the things that clearly is that there was, you know, there was the Mexican police that were had set up a blockade, and there was an attempt to get around it here. I mean, one of the things that sort of struck me is that there should have been greater coordination. I mean, I can't imagine that the Mexican government and the U.S. government, the Border Patrol, could not have coordinated things a little bit better rather than ultimately resorting to tear gas here. I don't know. I guess I'm not persuaded that this was some kind of instigators on the Mexican side that were seeking to, you know, create an incident. But I think what really struck me was that there was not a better a relationship here in terms of managing the number of people there and the seeking of asylum. Of course, this goes with the whole issue that, you know, there was a court case decided in San Francisco where the district judge said that the new rules that the Trump administration put into effect, that saying that if you came into the country illegally, you could not seek asylum, and the judge threw that out because the U.S. asylum law says that you can enter legally or illegally and still get make claims for asylum. So maybe that also fits into this picture.
Tim Hagel, your thoughts on the border situation?
Well, on that last point, of course, the Trump administration is probably going to appeal that particular decision. So, as always, we'll have to see how the courts sort that out. I hadn't thought about the idea that maybe somebody had tried to instigate the thing to create an incident. That may be possible. We'll have to, again, as my favorite phrase, we'll wait and see. But even if there hadn't, you can sort of understand the frustration of the people that perhaps had been told that, yes, you can get into the United States by people that were sort of advocating a more open borders type of position. And then that frustration occurs. Now they're sort of stuck here. They can't get through very quickly. And, you know, tensions are rising. So all of a sudden you have this rush to the border. Apparently there was also some stone throwing, which apparently Homeland Security was suggesting that was what caused the tear gas to be fired at the people, and the fact that there were women and children, they say, well, we can't help that because of the folks that we were trying to get at were mixed among the other folks. And so it's just sort of a bad situation all around, and definitely bad optics, to use that word, in terms of what's happening there, and doesn't help to find some sort of reasonable resolution, plus all the other things we've got going on here in the United States in terms of what Congress and its ability to deal with this type of situation.
Mm-hmm. Let's go back to the future House. We mentioned that in our first half hour, with the Democrats picking up 39, possibly 40 seats. We talked a little bit about the Senate in the first half hour. Let's focus a little on the House. Democrats expecting to elect Nancy Pelosi. It's been interesting over the last few days seeing the challenge to her leadership. She met with incoming Democrats yesterday. She acknowledged their, I think, idealism, integrity, and imagination, in her words, but warned against intransigence. So, Jim, what did that insurgency against Pelosi reveal about the Democratic House majority to you?
Well, I think it revealed really that there are divisions within the Democrats. I mean, they may have been, united in terms of opposing Trump in the midterm election, but some of the more anti-Pelosi people, have taken a much different stance. So I think there's a division among Democrats. I hate to say it this way, but there is probably a generational difference that is being played out here. Not precisely, but certainly some of the newer, younger members are going to want a bigger stake in, stake in the outcomes and a bigger place at the table here. And I think that's what the sort of the challenge. My immediate reaction was that was what the challenge to Pelosi was really about.
Mm. Do you have a different reading, Tim?
Not too different from that. in terms of the leadership that we see for the Democrats with Pelosi, that as much as she occasionally would get criticism from members of her own caucus, she's a smart lady and she basically has a lot of power. And so even though they were talking, oh, yes, somebody was suggesting that Representative Fudge might challenge her, maybe somebody else, we'd seen that in the past. Mm-hmm. I just didn't think that it was going to happen. And sure enough, they sort of folded because Nancy Pelosi has that ability to distribute favors of various sorts and to get people that are involved in various ways. And that's going to be the key thing is to, as was indicated, this happened with apparently Fudge, where she was put on a committee and basically saying, okay, you're going to have a seat at the table, a voice at the table, however you want to phrase it. And that's probably going to be the case for some of the younger members too. But I think there probably is something to the idea that there is this generational aspect to it. But as even some of the younger members were saying, well, as long as Pelosi represents the most progressive person that's running for speaker, that they're going to get their vote. This was...
Right. That was a representative from New York was saying that. Yeah.
Right. So reiterate that. Say that again. Make that point again, Tim.
That it has her full name, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez.
That's right.
AOC.
Yes.
I'm just going to go with AOC.
The youngest member of Congress.
The youngest member who can't run for president, so folks don't get your hopes up yet, at least not for 2020. In any case, she was saying that as long as Pelosi is the most progressive person running for speaker, that's who she would vote for, despite maybe concerns or some qualms along other lines. And so in that regard, that if nobody else really steps up, and this is what some other members had said, too, that were maybe not overly happy with Pelosi, would like to have seen somebody else run. Mm-hmm. They said, well, you can't beat somebody with nobody. And that's true. And so if Pelosi manages to keep everybody else off the ballot, so to speak, then she's going to be the next speaker, which I would expect anyway.
What really struck me, though, too, is the way that Pelosi was, even when this challenge arose, the way she was able to maneuver. And it really demonstrated her skill, her legislative skill, and also her stature within the Congress to put down these kind of challenges here. So I admire her in that respect very much.
Jim McCormick of Iowa State University, Tim Hagel of the University of Iowa, our political scientist on this edition of Politics of River to River, Politics Wednesday. Jim, I wanted to draw on your expertise in foreign policy, especially to have you give us comment on the Russia-Ukraine standoff on Sunday. Russia opened fire on the Ukrainian boats, then seized them, their crews. Since then, Moscow and Kiev have been trying to pin the blame on each other. I don't know. Can you recap, Jim, what happened on Sunday? There was a ramming by the Russian military boat. This is the first time that the Ukraine and Russian militaries have gone head-to-head.
Yeah, well, there's this Sea of Azov, which Ukraine and Russia both share, and they had signed an agreement back in 2003, I believe, in terms of safe passage and so on through the straits there. And this is where this incident happened, is that the Russians apparently blocked the straits before they had been checking Ukrainian boats that had been going into this kind of sea that ultimately goes into the Black Sea, and now suddenly they were stopping them, and they seized at least three vessels here. As you said, they actually closed the strait here. This is very much a power play by Russia, it seems to me, in terms of trying to again further intimidate the Ukrainian government here, because getting access to one of the ports of Ukraine within that sea is crucial in terms of their both exports, but also some of their imports that go into Ukraine. So it is, I think, a signal to Ukraine about being more compliant, if you will, or at least not antagonistic to Russian interests here. The other explanations that have been advanced are kind of interesting. One is a kind of a domestic explanation, in the sense that Putin did this again to kind of prop up his domestic support here that has been, with the economy declining and so on, that this kind of action will give him a greater support. And also yet a third explanation, and this really goes to the U.S. as well as to the European partners, is What would the U.S. and the European American European partners actually do in response to this? Mm-hmm. Because so far, the takeover of Crimea has met with a very loud diplomatic outcries and some sanctions, but certainly the kind of the stalemate that has existed there, the ongoing war has continued. The Europeans were quite vocal and quite quickly came out, and NATO, I noticed, came out with a statement as well. The president, at least initially, said he didn't like what was going on, and now the latest statement is that maybe he'll, not meet with Putin at the G20, which is scheduled at the end of the month here in Argentina. We'll wait, as Tim would say, we'll wait and see on that. I mm-hmm. suspect that's unlikely because that's an opportunity for the president to be on a major stage.
Mm-hmm. Interesting that the Ukraine's top diplomat in Germany urging the Germans and other Western states to punish Russia by extending sanctions, banning energy imports, and then we have this Nord Stream 2 gas pipeline. The president has talked about this, increasing the dependence of Western Europe upon Russia gas. All right,
he's particularly gone after the Germans on this.
Exactly. Well, the Ukrainian ambassador to Germany even raising the possibility, I don't know if you saw this, Jim, of sending German Marines to the region. The quote, "Germany must take a clear line and put Russian President Vladimir Putin in his place." This is the ambassador, the Ukrainian ambassador to Germany, telling German radio, everything is at stake. So Ukrainians seeing this as a dire threat.
It really is, yeah. And there seems to be no – and plus, putting the captured Ukrainian sailors on apparently on Russian television here as well, is a further affront, it seems to me, and sort of escalating this kind of conflict. I would be skeptical that the German Marines would take any kind of that kind of vigorous action. They'll really, if any action would be taken, it would be under the NATO label, it seems to me.
Mm-hmm. As we finish up in these last few minutes, I wanted to get your thoughts, Jim and Tim, on the president casting doubt on a report by our own government, a warning of devastating effects for climate change. The report found that climate change will cost the U.S. hundreds of billions of dollars annually, will damage health, a whole laundry list of negative effects of climate change. When asked outside the White House about the findings that unchecked global warming would wreak havoc on the U.S. economy, the president said, "I don't believe it." Now, of course, the world scientists agree that climate change is caused by humans and warn that natural fluctuations in temperature are being exacerbated by human activity. Let's listen to our U.S. senator speaking on CNN on Sunday. Senator Joni Ernst asked about the dire Trump administration's climate change report that was released. Here's her response.
Well, we know that our climate is changing. Our climate always changes, and we see those ebb and flows through time. American agriculture has faced very difficult situations in decades past as well. I think there are a number of things that we can do, and Iowa certainly is stepping up and is a leader on making sure that we are keeping our air, our water, and our soil healthy. And we lead in things like solar energy and wind energy.
Okay, sort of a typical GOP response from what I have gathered, Tim, over the years. And Jim, the climate's changing. It has always changed, right, Tim?
Well, that's certainly true.
I mean, that's you hear from Republicans, though, right?
Well, sure. Well, I don't know that the Democrats would deny that aspect to it. The question is when you get into A, what's the cause and to what extent is it caused by humans? And B, what can we do about it?
What are we going to do about it?
And if the things that you want to do about it, how is that going to affect the economy immediately as opposed to whatever's going to happen in 80 to 100 years or however it is? And those are usually the fights that occur.
Mm-hmm. Jim, why doesn't our president believe his own government report and the consensus of the vast majority of climate scientists around the world?
Well, I just think he has wedded himself to this position, and he's so concerned about, propping up the American economy here that, you know, any kind of change in, you know, to address climate change, I suspect he thinks it's going to damage the economy, you know, at least his view of how the economy should be expanded here. So I think that's why he's kind of wedded to this position. I mean, his legacy is going to be improving the economy. He said that, you know, over and over again, mm-hmm. Maybe not in those exact words, but putting so much emphasis on expanding the economy, and the kind of cutbacks that would have to be taken might have these kind of short-term economic effects. Although, as that report suggested, the one that came out, at the end of the week, last week, 10% of the American economy would be affected by right. By some of the failure to address the climate change. So the long-term solution is pretty negative, but maybe the short-term gain, and politicians live in that short-term umbrella. I think that would be part of the explanation. The other thing that came out, and you may have seen that just on Monday, another report from the UN. It said that even at the current level, the national commitments that have been made under the Paris Agreement are not going to, you know, meet the 2030 standards, and they actually call for greater commitments by nations. The other thing, and particularly in response to Senator Ernst's comment, that same report said that it was not going to really be possible that the subnational units could really pick up for the slack of the failure of national governments. Now, whether that is true in the short term or long term, it's really quite, I think, startling to me when I read it, in the sense that, you know, we have heard so much about how states have been active in terms of mm-hmm. taking some kind of changes, but the real concern in this report was, and admittedly it's through the United Nations and it looks at states here, was that states take a much greater stake in making changes.
Okay, Jim McCormick, professor of political science at Iowa State University, Tim Hagel, associate professor of political science at the University of Iowa. Thank you both for joining us today.
Welcome.
Thank you very much.
Just a note here, while we're on the topic, next week on this program, we'll be exploring how Iowa farmers and others in the ag community in the Midwest are dealing with climate change. River to River is produced by Emily Woodbury, Caitlin Harrop, and Lindsay Moon. Help today from Alyssa Bovinette. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.